This is part three of our fourth session, and it's May 15th, 2006. Okay, continuing there with book two, chapter two of Finney's Wake, the children's study hour, the school book textbook chapter, different names for basically the twins, Shem and Sean, and their sister, Olivia, whatever the sister's name was, forget her name, Issy. They are doing their homework. And Joyce lays out the design of the chapter to mirror the trivium, dialectics, grammar, and rhetoric. So he has lots of footnotes at the bottom of the page and on each side of the page, and the middle of the book, the prose in the middle, is shrunk down, smaller print, and doesn't cover the whole page. So it's bordered by three sets of footnotes. Those three sets of footnotes are Shem or Sean, I can't remember which, is the dialectician on the right or left page, side of the page. Shem or Sean is the rhetorician or grammarian, I can't remember, on the other side. And then you have the Issy in the bottom doing the rhetorician or grammatical. There's one of the notes that comes to me, I haven't looked at this in a lot, many years, but maybe the dialectic is the Shem and Sean going on, and different right and left-hand side, and the rhetorical grammars in the bottom, represented by Issy. So, not sure about that, but the trivium is laid out in the structure, bordering the main paragraphs. And the main paragraphs, a lot of the content is based on mathematics, music, astronomy, and arithmetic. So, what is the quadrivium? Music, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy. A lot of that's in the content of this chapter. So the quadrivium is the content, and it's framed by the multifarious footnotes, which is the trivium, right? We got that?
Mm-hmm.
And now, why was I bringing that up? So then McLuhan's PhD thesis, done a couple years after Joyce's book comes out in 1939, McLuhan puts out his thesis in 43. He's working on the thesis in 39, 40, 41. He ends the thesis with reference to James Joyce, so he actually is working his thesis around the themes presented in that chapter in Finnegan's Wake. And McLuhan would be familiar with Finnegan's Wake because he could read it in the Transition magazine before it was published, where it was serialized as titled Work in Progress. So McLuhan's study of Finney's Wake had a big influence on his PhD.
Well, before television was environmental, I guess people knew about it in 39 and 40, but was he thinking in terms of television media at that time?
No. He was still within the Gutenberg culture and was talking about the different actions, the dialectical battles with the grammarians and the rhetoricians. He actually saw a pattern over the last 2,000 years. I don't know, it would be 2,500 years. He saw a pattern of just before the phonetic alphabet and then after it, you know, 500 BCE, before the Common Era. And he worked out a whole pattern of interplay of the trivium factions. And it was an original view of the history of Western scholarship. He actually made a breakthrough. But by the 43, 44, 45, he was interacting with Wyndham Lewis, and he realized, well, that was just Gutenberg stuff. And he had to deal with the 20th century, especially his students. They weren't interested in whatever he brought from Cambridge, which was this thesis. So he had to start studying pop culture.
Yeah, I noticed on your chart you have, in the McLuhan quadrant, you have Wyndham Lewis. I would have guessed it was going to be Joyce, but you got Joyce way down in the Bob quadrant.
No, McLuhan is a Lewisite more than Joyce, but that's a whole other issue.
That's a distraction.
We actually been posting, you get the McLuhan L list. I've been saying stuff on there about that.
Mm-hmm.
You get that list?
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't get the McLuhan? You're not on the McLuhan L list?
No.
Oh, man, we've been doing a lot on Lewis and Joyce and McLuhan last 6 months. You know, Andrew Crystal down in New Zealand got new letters where McLuhan's talking about these issues.
Yeah. Well, you've been selecting some of those letters and sending them out to the group.
Right, to the pop group. Okay, so now, let's go back to the quote here. It's in interesting how McLuhan projects back the medium as a message to and applies it to Milton. He's projecting that Milton. I don't know. Did we do this on the previous session today?
Yeah, I think we pretty much covered Paradise Lost.
I won't go into that.
Yeah.
Now, let's say Satan is this archetypal phenomenon way back in human history as a concept or as a fact, whatever he is. And the thing is, he doesn't numb the environment. He gets numbed himself. So it's almost a psychological dilemma. Now, literacy does create psychology, as we know it, the individual psyche and how it relates to the to the collective. So this could be a literate effect of psychology is what Milton is concerned with, but putting that aside and saying, well, Satan...
Yeah, he's using Satan as the archetype, but this happened to all of us. And he's
right.
Probably aware of that.
Who's aware of it?
Milton's probably aware of that.
Right, but no, but Satan is the archetype of the beginning of the human world or something.
Right.
You know, he's back there at the beginning. So Satan is... He's like the first medium who numbs himself. He's the first extension from God, creates his own environment, and numbs himself. Now, we move up to the 20th century. Who's the 20th century Satan? Let's take Henry Luce, the inventor of Time magazine and Life magazine. In the 30s and 40s, Time and Life was considered almost a monocrop mentality. It was by literary...
Monocrop? I'm not familiar with that term.
Monocrop is in modern agriculture, the Green Revolution, where they wipe out local diversity and just plant acres of some one crop.
Yeah.
And
corporate takeover of farming.
Yeah, and put a lot of pesticides and ruin the local ecology. Monocrop. So here's Luce projecting a monocrop hegemony or hegemony over the news consumption of people. Many literate Christian humans objected to the vulgarity of Time and Life and how they treated the news society. William Burroughs was especially critical of Time magazine and many others, and so was McLuhan. He once said, "How could you write the truth in Time style?" Interesting statement. So here's Henry Luce being like the modern agent of Big Brother, a hot medium projecting this thing over the radio era. He is someone who invented a new way to present journalism, but then through its very excess and success, he may have become unaware of the disservice of Time and Life. So he's the updated version of Satan, but he's dealing with not his thinking, but an environment, a media environment he created.
So in the magazine world.
Yeah, and Luce is therefore numbing himself, suffering intellectual anesthesia, like Satan, replaying this satanic pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that Luce later went on, I think in the 50s, early 60s, and took LSD. He maybe, as the quote says, Milton solves this problem wittily by showing how Satan uses language to obscure his thinking. Well, maybe in the speeded-up 20th century, Luce became aware of his own intellectual anesthesia and sought the latest anti-environment psychedelics to retrieve his thinking.
Yeah.
So, is that the end of that thought? I think that's as far as we went with that, right?
Yeah. The next paragraph, which is from Gutenberg Galaxy,
page 314.
Yeah, really moves us in a whole new direction with McLuhan here. This is a meaty statement.
Yeah.
Imagination is that ratio among the perceptions and faculties which exist when they are not embedded or outered in material technologies. When so outered, each sense and faculty becomes a closed system.
Now,
that's a slippery statement. But go ahead.
You see here, we're still saying the medium is a message here. It's interesting he's taking the word imagination, which is a culturally loaded term. I mean, Western literate society really values imagination, supposedly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And imagination would be, it would seem, something that's hypersensitive to the environment and knows how to make something out of it. The images and data in the environment, the artist, painter, writer, they have an imagination. They work with what's given, the cliches, and imagine something new.
Yeah, as long as the imagination actually is yoked to the environment. I mean, imagination can run off into the world of fantasy and have no connection at all to...
Right. But isn't, take what you just said, imagination, no connection. But McLuhan does a reverse definition of imagination. To me, the cliche would have been imagination is very involved and observant, involved in the sensory data, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says imagination is that ratio among the perceptions and faculties,
mm-hmm.
our senses, which exists, the ratio which exists when they are not embedded.
Mm-hmm.
Or outered, that means extended, in material technologies.
Right.
So the perceptions, is that ratio among the perceptions? That's what the person makes out of the environment. The faculties are the senses giving the brain the data. So the ratio between perceiving the sensory data, what the individual alters and makes, and the smarter you are, you can work with the given sensory data or the stuff coming from your faculties. The ratio between perceptions and faculties is complemented, a valued state of being, when, called imagination, when they, the perceptions of faculties, are not embedded or outered in material technologies. He's saying you got to be very detached with your immediate environment, not involved in sensorily observing. There's a you could even bring in your Buddhist detachment. There's a detachment about the immediate environment that allows you to mold it.
Mm-hmm.
And you mold it between what the faculties give you and what your perceptions want to design them towards.
Mm-hmm.
When so outered, when you're embedded, when your faculties and perceptions are outered or embedded in material technologies, each sense and faculty becomes a closed system.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same as intellectual anesthesia.
Yeah, a closed system in terms of being like a feedback loop that can't...
That's numbed.
Numbed, yeah. So it's you're perceiving the media, it's inputting, you're perceiving its input, it's... I'm not quite sure how to break that down, but there's some kind of a loop going on in it, creating this...
You don't have any environment. You can't see one thing unless you look through another. But if a society like most societies up to the 20th century were conditioned by the tools and artifact language they had, they found other cultures very strange and hard to deal with because they were in a closed system. Their culture molded them, massaged them into a particular bias.
Mm-hmm.
The artist, or even before the artist, the seer, the prophet, the biblical prophet comes from an outside position. The biblical prophet out in the wilderness gets away from the sensory closed system of the culture, then comes back in and offers an anti-environment to wake the people up or to shift their addictions, their natural assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
So the way McLuhan has it, that the scientist, the prophet, the seer, the artist, the kid on the street, they are imaginative. It's not a Gutenberg galaxy idea of imagination where you have interesting ideas and notions and images and then you make an artifact and you sell it.
Mm-hmm.
This is media ecology. Imagination is not something that creates product. It is a relationship to the medium around.
Mm-hmm.
It's a media yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another way of dealing with the intellectual anesthesia or the cultural anesthesia that's in Milton's Paradise Lost,
mm-hmm.
as via McLuhan's interpretation of that. So imagination is that ratio, flexible ratio, among the perspectives which exist when they are not embedded.
Now, that right there is ambiguous to me, because what is he saying? There's a homeostatic ratio that everyone, that everyone falls into resonance with when the perceptions and faculties, when they're not, embedded in the perceptions and faculties, that there's a sort of natural ratio that automatically stabilizes among the, that's a little question mark for me.
Okay. The ratio among the perception faculties which exist when they are not embedded. He talks in another, in Hot and Cool, page 107, which may be different page number, different editions, but basically 107. He says that the golden section in classical Greek knowledge had the same meaning as the resonant interval in Zen Buddhism in Asia. It was that balanced relationship between tensions and sensory input. That's not the exact word, but he talks about the dynamic balance of tensions among sensory ratios. If you're in that situation, you're in the golden section or the resonant interval. But some people might call enlightenment. So yes, he is saying that the ratio, there's almost a certain kind of ratio, but that ratio is not the same ratio, or its constituents are not in the same position, because when you're in any environment to whatever culture you're in, and that culture could be visual, acoustic, kinetic, or tactile, depending what it is, you complement that with the other counter environment of sensory relationships.
Mm-hmm. So when you say golden section, what comes to mind is, I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I visualize the spiral of the conch shell.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that relates to what we're talking about here in terms of the resonant gap.
Well, the golden section is the visual version in visual society, Greek society, as the Zen interval, which comes through dialogue with the guru, is acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
So they're two different cultural terms for the same phenomenon of a balanced ratio, but they're different means of expressing that ratio, which is the point here. Imagination is that ratio, and that ratio is determined when it's balanced or aware of other sensory modalities, because it's not embedded in the body of that culture. That ratio can be called imagination. So imagination is a new term to substitute for golden section or the Zen interval.
Mm-hmm. And when he talks about outered in material technologies, so he's saying that the phatic guy out, primitive guy out in nature, he's not embedded in material technologies, so his sensory ratios are naturally balanced.
They are balanced by the environment he's in. They aren't necessarily balanced, but relation to the culture,
yeah.
He's an anti-environment. He has a different balance.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm seeing that it's like you put a couple more pounds on one side of a teeter-totter, and the other side, one side starts to come down, the other side starts to come up. There's a direct relationship.
Right.
So there's a direct relationship between the function of imagination and the environment, that the cultural environment that it finds itself in. They're affecting each other.
Beg your pardon?
Affecting each other, they're sculpting each other.
Right. The imaginative entity fills in the senses that are not
embedded,
conscious.
Yeah.
So, in the Gutenberg galaxy, where the people became hyper embedded to the extension of the eye, the literate technologies, the eye became embedded or outered in material technologies, in this case, the Gutenberg technologies.
Mm-hmm.
The anti-environment to that is great classical music, step up the acoustic.
Oh.
And they took the visual space, and they split off the instruments and song from speech. I mean, speech and song were together in the feudal period. But when you wrote out the notes and hyped up the instruments and really developed them, and you don't even have anybody singing, you know, this is Bach kind of music, and Mozart and Beethoven, they're specializing in fragmenting music, but they need it to hype, they need to do that to heighten its intensity to counter the visual numbness. of that society of that era.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, when so outered, so embedded, so extended. Embedded, outered, extended all have the same meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when your eye is extended by books.
Mm-hmm.
You've extended your eye. It's going into a new zone. But through overuse and habituation to that new novelty, it becomes embedded or stuck or closed. And it's been outered as a disservice.
Right.
So he's mixing the words here. Imagination is that ratio among the perceptional faculties which exists when they are not embedded or outered in material technologies.
Right.
When they're not extended.
Yeah. So it even goes beyond material technologies, because caveman has to be aware of the fact that the big fanged mountain lion thing is, you know, might be right close by, ready to pounce on him. So that's affecting the way that his senses are outered in his environment, because he has to pay attention to certain elements of his environment for his survival.
Yeah.
And so that's going to shape his imagination. It seems to me the only way to conclude what's going on with these sensory ratios, and probably this isn't even true, when the senses are not outered, is to go into like the total sensory deprivation tank, or to become like a Helen Keller or something like that. She still had the sense of touch. I mean, you'd have to like go into the isolation tank, in which case the imagination seems to be free to project whatever it wants to, and apparently does, according to people that do research in that field.
Well, wait, you were talking about the 20th century when you brought in the sensory tank?
Yeah.
Yeah, because what happens in the sensory tank is you cut off light and sound. And so it's a perfect expression of McLuhan's understanding of sensory involvement. Immediately, your brain, your sensory cognitive processes, start filling in sight and sound.
Yeah.
So the sensory fill-in is the natural process of sensory interaction. But McLuhan took it collectively. When everybody is extended as a society into the eye, you're going to see inventions of the ear to balance off. Now, this is the hidden part of McLuhan, is that there's always an ecology going on in every culture.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an ecology, a great balance going on in the 20th century, if you know how to see it. And one of the ways to do it is say, okay, we got our senses. They're always talking to each other, they're always remaining in balance as each one is stressed on in different material sensory milieus.
That's the function of the tactility doing all that.
Yeah, and look at the extended sensory landscapes responding to stresses caused by earlier sensory biased technological landscapes.
Mm.
So the landscape of the eye, known as the Gutenberg galaxy, was balanced off by painting, music, and sculpture, the non-visual arts.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the great period of art, so to speak, 1500 to 1800.
Yeah, the Renaissance.
Right, the Renaissance and then the later development. You look across the society and you see there's an interesting collective ecology going on, a collective adjustment
mm-hmm.
that mimes the tactile adjustment within each body.
Right.
And the theory is based on the idea that if you go one outering of the sense, one heightening of it, it will be balanced by others. For example, McLuhan used to always cite that dentists counter the pain of the drill by putting high-pitched sounds in the patient's ears.
Mm-hmm.
He cited that. I don't know if that was ever done. Never was done to me. He may have read about it and decided it was a metaphor and it never got applied, or maybe it was done, but certainly most people.
Sure.
Have you ever heard of that?
No, but I can see how it would be true. See, you're so focused on that. You've got you're laid back, you're relaxed, your eyes are often closed, and the drill is going into your tooth. All of your focus of attention is on that without any distraction. You totally amplify it, probably out of proportion. But if one of your other senses becomes distracted to the point where you don't hardly notice the drill because you're paying attention to something else.
Yeah, the senses are plastic and malleable, so you heightened the ear sense, the audiac, I think McLuhan called it, in that particular example. You heighten the audiac to balance the intensity of the kinesthetic proprioceptor, whatever you want to call the sensory apparatus of a drill.
Yeah, and because of the intensity of the drill, the intensity of the sound being high frequency matches the intensity of the drill.
Yes, so what goes on in the isolation tank proves to you that the senses are always filling in.
Yeah.
And balancing whatever is being deprived.
Yeah. And, of course, that happens to us when we go to fall asleep. We withdraw from the senses and the dream life becomes, you know, alive.
Yeah, and actually, you have a very vibrant fill-in by the dream life.
Yeah.
So this statement is pretty obvious now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just as a footnote, what do you think we can say then that the golden mean is it can be a visual icon or representation of the tactile, which has no, you know, visual sense,
right,
actually.
Yeah. And the Zen interval, the Buddhist interval of enlightenment, is the acoustic version of the tactile.
Yeah, okay.
And then television itself is the extension of tactility.
Right.
It's the tactile version of tactility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... So the quote, and see, I always like this quote because imagination, and then how he defines it, is totally not what people think imagination is in our culture.
Yeah, what do I think of it as being, you know, being creative and coming up with some new idea that you can fashion into something.
It's like fantasizing and inventive, dreaming new things.
Yeah.
That's the school classroom kind of the imagination.
Although the cultural icon for imagination is the poster of Einstein with the E equals MC² saying that he prizes imagination above all other faculties.
Right. And yet here's McLuhan defining imagination technically, understanding it as a concept in relation to technological grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Totally original. Right?
Right.
Imagination is that ratio among the perceptions and faculties which exists when they are not embedded or outered in material technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Then he supplements by saying, when so outered, in other words, he's talking about the anesthesia, each sense and faculty becomes a closed system.
Mm-hmm.
That sentence just repeats the meaning of the previous sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when so outered, each sense and faculty becomes a closed system. He's saying that in the previous sentence, imagination is that ratio among the perception faculties which exists when they are not embedded or outer to material technologies, or when they are not in a closed system.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have that, those three quotes. Then the next quote is?
The next quote is, it's just a, it's a very brief sentence from The Interior Landscape, page 63, and it says, the analogical mirrors, period, and it's all capitalized.
Well, the first letter of each word.
Because
it's the title of an essay.
Mm.
But the three words tell us a lot because we've been talking about the spoken word is mirror, the canon is mirror, there's no mirror in the satanic thing and none in the imagination. But what's important is he's not talking about one mirror. He's talking about the different mirrors, which would be each sensory form, each sensory faculty. Each one is a kind of mirror in its own space. And they are analogies for the technologies that are extensions of those sensory mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a loaded phrase. It's a key phrase. I think McLuhan laid it out about 1943. And so he's aware of not just the visual mirror, but the other senses as mirrors. And he knows that they're going to be his analogies for using technologies as analogical mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be extensions of the sensory mirrors. You're going to get the technological mirrors. And each of these technological mirrors will have different sensory ratios. So it's a loaded two words, analogical mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
Or three if you include the "the".
Mm-hmm.
So I'm laying out these quotes. I'm trying to sort of give a little bit of a chronological acquaintance to the student in order and develop from simpler notions to more complex as the McLuhan section unravels. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Let me just read a definition of analogy as pertains to analogical mirrors, just for my own edification. Comparison between two things, typically on the basis of their structure and for the purpose of explanation or clarification. Also, correspondence or partial similarity or likeness.
Of two things, what'd you say?
Yeah.
The last word?
Well, I think the first definition holds here. A comparison between two things, typically on the basis of their structure and for the purpose of explanation or clarification.
Right, so, and that's the definition of an analogy.
Analogy.
Right, because another word is metaphor. McLuhan said that all experience needs to be translated into another experience, and that's the role of metaphor, which means to bridge.
Right.
So the tactile organism translates one experience into another. It's like McLuhan's statement that the relationships between objects are observable. And that's all that's observable. Objects themselves are not observable. So when we interact with speech as a model, two people interacting, they translate each other into each other. And that's the human community, and that's the establishing of a human medium. So the definition of analog or metaphor is an explanation of looking at one thing through another, which
right.
is consciousness.
Right. Which is retrieving an earlier rhetorical definition of metaphor, unlike the dialectic idea of metaphor that we're...
Well, remember when you used to be taught a difference between simile and metaphor?
Mm-hmm.
Simile was something was exactly like something.
Mm-hmm.
If you said it was red as something, there was a matching element going on.
Right.
Red as a rose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with metaphor, they're not exactly matched. There's a ratio.
Mm.
A is to B, is C is to D.
Right.
I used to say that Carolyn was the Wayne Gretzky of Canadian medicine. He started very early and burst on the scene. So did Carolyn. So as the A is Carolyn is to medicine, as Gretzky is to hockey.
Right.
There's no exact. It's not red as a rose.
Yeah.
There's an approximation going on of two different contexts.
Yeah, and a bit of an anti-environment going on, which kind of shows off helps to define the thing
right.
that you're doing.
To contrast and compare,
yeah.
and not necessarily to clarify in terms of precision of matching knowledge, but to clarify by suggestion,
mm-hmm.
and to recover the ratio faculty in cognition.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that good enough?
Yeah.
The important thing is that, you know, mirrors implies eye stuff. We're going to move into the echo world. But McLuhan is not numbed. He's showing here he's not numbed by the mirror and that there's only one kind of mirror. He's saying that the mirror can be multisensory and then analogized onto technologies.
Mm-hmm.
The book is a metaphor for the eye space.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's an approximation of the eye space. As the eye is to my body, and the modalities the eye creates is to my body, is like the book is to the collective human community.
Mm-hmm.
The eye isolates, the book isolates. The eye has an isolating function in my brain, as opposed to a interpenetrating function of the ear.
In the sense of the ear hears all the sounds coming from all spherical directions.
Yes.
But the eye just looks at, you could adjust your gaze so you could take in the whole horizon, but then you adjust your gaze. You're looking for your pencil, so all of a sudden now your eyes are looking at tearing little bits of the landscape apart to find this particular thing you're looking for.
Yeah, you're pinpointing.
Pinpointing.
Or pen pointing.
Yeah.
So the ratio of the style of the eye in relation to the larger body can be analogized in looking at the relationship of print and as an extension of the eye in relation to the collective human artifacts up to that point,
mm-hmm.
or the collective human media,
mm-hmm.
which is the collective body of second nature, right?
Right.
So it's an analogy.
Right.
Okay, so... We're running out of time. We've got
11 minutes. We've got about 10 minutes on this side of the tape.
We're going to end on this.
Okay.
I'm not going to go on to side two.
Okay.
So let's end this side. for today.
All right.
And we got a really good quote coming up.
Right. We'll get into it. Probably won't be able to finish it in 10 minutes. It's from Myth and Mass Media, page 340, Marshall McLuhan.
Oh, we didn't say Analogical Mirrors is page 63, or maybe you did, Interior Landscape.
Yeah.
Now, this is from an essay, a magazine called Daedalus, Spring 1959, number 2, and it's page 340. Now, what's really important in this is you're going to see the use of the word myth.
Yeah.
How does he use the word myth and media?
Right. Okay.
Okay, this is before he wrote Gutenberg Galaxy.
Okay. If a language contrived and used by many people is a mass medium, any one of our new media is, in a sense, a new language, a new codification of experience, collectively achieved by new work habits and inclusive collective awareness. But when such new codification has reached the technological stage of communicability and repeatability, has it not, like a spoken tongue, also become a macro myth? How much compression of the elements of a process must occur before one can say they are certainly in mythic form? Are we inclined to insist that myth be a reduction of collective experience to a visual and classifiable form? Languages old and new as macromyths have that relation to words and word making that characterizes the fullest scope of myth. The collective skills and experience that constitute both spoken languages and such new languages as movie or radio can also be considered with preliterate myths as static models of the universe. But do they not tend, like languages in general, to be dynamic models of the universe in action? As such, languages old and new would seem to be for participation rather than for contemplation, or for reference and classification.
So, what do you have any idea what this is about?
Well, I have this idea of the condensation of data of technology and media into mythic forms based on the Croker quadrant of your chart, but that probably is taking it to a different level than what McLuhan is saying here. So why don't you kick this one off?
We have the word myth, which in the 50s was considered to be pre-scientific and fake information, false information. There was the conventional meaning of myth for the literate person of the Gutenberg Galaxy, but myth was a pseudo form of knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to take this word myth and give it a new meaning and move it out of that stigma.
Mm-hmm.
So he begins by saying, if a language contrived and used by many people is a mass medium, any one of our new media is, in a sense, a new language. So he's trying to bring, starting now to make the connection between language and media. He's trying to say technologies are linguistic. You know, that's one of the basic things you begin explaining McLuhan is that you say he considers language as a machine,
mm-hmm.
which back in those days, the old days, was odd to people, right? Because
mm-hmm.
they were inside the Gutenberg split of humanities versus machines or humanities versus the sciences.
Yeah, and he's talking metaphorically. You can't take that literally.
No, look at how you... Metaphorically, are you saying that he's talking like a literate person? No.
Linguistic, doesn't that somehow imply the tongue and the speech, language, linguistic? We're saying that, you know, media is language regardless of whether or not it's spoken tongue.
Yeah. In other words, you think he's saying that machines are linguistic and that's a metaphor?
Yeah, I think...
Okay, let me show you how he tries to prove that, disprove your assumption, and this is what the first few sentences are about. If a language contrived and used by many people is a mass medium,
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any one of our new media is, in a sense, a new language. Now, why new media? Okay, he's thinking of television or radio.
Well, being a grammarian for a minute, I think of the word language as linguistics, and I think the word linguistics has something to do with the tongue and the mouth. So
well,
now,
that's the logocentric, mm-hmm. visual space version of language.
Oh.
Yeah, if a language, meaning a spoken language, not gestural language, but if a spoken language contrived and used by many people as a mass medium, any one of our new media is, in a sense, a new language. Now, he's not saying that our new media are new machines, but that's really what he's really doing. But most people think of media as communication artifacts, so yeah, they seem to be like language, so they have no problem with this. As one of our new media... Any one of our new media is, in a sense, a new language, then. Mm-hmm. A new codification of experience, like speech, I'm throwing that in, collectively achieved by new work habits that involves technology, and inclusive collective awareness. So he's saying, he's defining what a language is, and he's making you aware that, yeah, movies, print, television, are codifications of experience achieved by new work habits or how technologies make those media work, and they represent inclusive collective awareness. So he's expanding the word media to be more than linguist than language.
Mm-hmm.
It involves the new communication landscapes. But when such a new codification has reached the technological stage of communicability and repeatability, all right, here's now he's slipping in the technological part of media, right?
Mm-hmm.
Starting to say language is a machine. But when such a new codification has reached a technological stage of communicability and repeatability, has it not, like a spoken language, like a spoken tongue, also become a macro myth? If language is a myth, most people, I guess in this sense, he means myth as a story.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, language and the new technological environments are macro stories,
mm-hmm.
macro myths, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much compression of the elements of a process must occur before one can say that they are certainly a mythic form? Are we inclined to insist that myth be a reduction of collective experience to a visual and classifiable form? There's the Western literary bias. They took myths, analyzed the stories, and classified them.
Right.
But he's going to point out there's another meaning for myth, and we'll come to it, but I'll jump ahead. It's not a classification, but participation. We know about the Homeric poets, they would spew off the tales and be dancing and act out the whole poem. It wasn't just reading a poem. They'd act out the poem. But the audience would know the words and the stories, heard them 100 times, and they'd participate and interact with it. Like a rock concert, you know, yell back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a rap concert. So much multisensory interaction is what McLuhan's saying myth, pre-literate classified myth was.
Mm-hmm.
Before we classified it as, I mean, basically, the Gutenberg galaxy took ancient stories and wrote books about them.
Right.
They classified what was a non-book experience at the time they were vibrant, right, as an invisible environment 2,000 years ago.
Right.
So he's saying, how much must you compress a process before one can say it's certainly a mythic form?
Mm-hmm.
Is a television experience sufficiently compressed to be considered mythic?
Hmm.
Most people would say, yeah, it's mm-hmm. a selective editing package, bunch of information.
Right.
So.
Yeah, but now you're living inside the process of the myth as opposed to being detached and looking at it as a static thing on from the outside.
Yeah, static thing on the book.
Yeah.
So then that gets into the next paragraph. Language is old and new as macro myths. So, yes, he's saying that, just go back, but when such a new codification has reached the technological stage of communicability and repeatability, has it not, like a spoken tongue or language, also become a macromyth? Now, he's introduced the word macromyth and applying to technology, but he's saying languages are macromyths. Their content, their stories are myths, but the thing, it's the whole environment itself is a big form of myth. And what he means by myth is not something classified, but something you participate in. We participate in our technological landscapes. We participate in our languages. So he's bringing in the phatic nature, the participatory nature, not the emphasis on one meaning, one point.
Mm-hmm. It's a recycled experience. So language is old and new, as macromyths have that relation to words and work making. Language is old and new, as macromyths have that relation to words and word making that characterizes the fullest scope of myth. Just as myth is made up of stories and words, and the making of stories, languages and technologies make huge stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they impact on the audiences for them. The collective skills and experience that constitute both spoken languages, languages made up by hundreds of people in the culture contributing to the language, collective people are involved in making a language, just as there are many people making a movie or a radio show. The collective skills and experience that constitute both spoken languages and such new languages as movies or radio can also be considered with pre-literate myths as static models of the universe. In other words, he calls radio in Understanding Media the tribal dun, it's tribal drum. Movies is the real world, R-E-E-L. He has different, he calls television the Tibet giant. They're models for their time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the pictorial, pictogram, or visual bias of an eye image, a static model. Okay, so he's saying, we can use movies and media as static models. That's what he does in his books. The book says poetic prose. He's taking these medium...